from 8 till 10.
You produce your own oil and allow others to taste and see. Next, CFRC is good.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Tariffs will make this country very rich. We're rich anyway, but we're rich in a certain way. We have $36 trillion in debt. I want to get rid of it, and we can do it quickly with proper deals.
China's vowing to fight to the end as President Trump threatens to increase tariffs on China to more than 100%. We'll look at how auto workers in the U.S. and Mexico are responding to Trump's trade war. Then the Supreme Court pauses a court-imposed order for the U.S. to bring home a Maryland father who was mistakenly flown to a supermax prison in El Salvador. We'll speak to the family's lawyer and go to San Salvador to look more closely at the notorious prison being used to jail immigrants sent from the United States. Then, Black Americans are not surprised. That's the headline of a new piece in the New York Times by Fordham professor Christina Greer.
Black people in this particular moment are not surprised by this particular administration. What we've seen in the past, if we reckon with the real understanding of Black Americans in this country, we will understand so much of what is happening now.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Donald Trump welcomed Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to the White House Monday, where Trump repeated his call to permanently expel Palestinians from the Gaza Strip. Speaking to reporters from the Oval Office alongside Netanyahu, Vice President J.D. Vance, and top cabinet officials, Trump called Gaza, quote, an incredible piece of important real estate that he wants the U.S. to own and control.
Well, you know how I feel about the Gaza Strip. I think it's an incredible piece of important real estate. And I think it's something that we would be involved in. But, you know, having a peace force like the United States there, controlling and owning the Gaza Strip would be a good thing. Because right now, all it is for years and years, all I hear about is killing and Hamas and problems. And if you take the people, the Palestinians, and move them around to different countries, and you have plenty of countries that will do that, and you really have a freedom zone.
It was Netanyahu's second visit to the White House since Trump's inauguration, coming despite an international criminal court warrant seeking his arrest for war crimes and crimes against humanity committed in Gaza. During the meeting, Trump said the U.S. will hold direct talks with Iran on its nuclear program in Oman this weekend. Trump, who's repeatedly threatened to bomb Iran, said if the talks don't go well, quote, Iran's going to be in great danger, unquote. In Gaza, Palestinian journalist Ahmed Mansour has died a day after suffering severe burns from an Israeli strike on a tent housing reporters in Khan Yunis. Mansour was one of three people killed in the attack, which also killed a journalist with Palestine Today. Gaza's government media office reports Israeli attacks on Gaza since October 2023 have killed at least 211 Palestinian journalists. Israeli forces have killed at least 58 Palestinians in Gaza over the past 24 hours, with several children among the dead. The United Nations warns Israeli attacks on Gaza are now killing or injuring 100 children a day. This is Ghada Dabebek, a 6-year-old girl who lost her arm with an Israeli strike last week.
I was playing at school. I was playing on the swing. I was bombed. My arm, I got injured here on my arm. My arm was amputated.
The Palestine Red Crescent Society is demanding an independent investigation into the killing of 15 Palestinian medics and rescue workers in Gaza by Israel's military March 23rd. Victims of the attack near Rafah were discovered buried in a mass grave with their vehicles, ambulances, and a fire truck buried nearby. A Red Crescent spokesperson called the attack a, quote, full-fledged war crime.
We need justice for the victims, and we need to ensure that all of those who are responsible are held to account. Without this, the crimes will continue to happen. Without this, the systematic targeting for humanitarians, aid workers, and medics will continue to happen.
Nabal Farsakh is with the Palestine Red Crescent Society. Protests against Israel's U.S.-backed war on Gaza are continuing. Here in New York, Palestinian rights demonstrators descended on Grand Central Station Monday. Elsewhere, protesters gathered in front of the U.N. headquarters to demand the protection of mothers and pregnant women in Gaza as U.N. officials held an event on maternal and newborn health for World Health Day. Separately, the group Taxpayers Against Genocide delivered a report to the U.N. Human Rights Council Monday exposing U.S. complicity in systemic injustice and human rights violations against Palestinians. Meanwhile, at Princeton University, students protested an event featuring former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. This is 21-year-old Princeton student Emmanuel Sippy, the daughter of a rabbi and president of Princeton Alliance of Jewish Progressives.
Bennett has enabled violence at the highest levels of government and public life that attempt to justify violence that cannot be justified, killing that cannot be fathomed. His presence on our campus is a desecration of God's name. To his enabling of apartheid, genocide, and annexation, Jews at Princeton say, not in our name.
Microsoft has fired two workers who protested the company's ties to Israel's assault on Gaza at its 50th anniversary celebration Friday. Microsoft supplies the Israeli military with AI and cloud technology. This is software engineer Iptahal Abusad, who organizes with the Microsoft employee-led campaign No Azure for Apartheid, confronting Microsoft AI CEO Mustafa Suleiman.
So the question I wanted to address today is really simple. What does all this mean?
Mustafa, shame on you. You say you claim that you care about using AI for good, but Microsoft sells AI weapons to the Israeli military. 50,000 people have died, and Microsoft powers this genocide in our region.
Thank you for your protest. I hear you.
You're hearing them. You know about this, Mustafa.
I hear your protest. Thank you.
Shame on you are a war profiteer. Stop using AI for genocide, Mustafa.
Last week, the BDS, that's Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions National Committee, announced Microsoft as a priority target and called on consumers to boycott its gaming subscriptions and products like Xbox. In more tech news, an Al Jazeera investigation finds Facebook hosted over 100 paid advertisements promoting illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. The ads, approved by Meta, were calls for the demolition of Palestinian homes, schools, and playgrounds, and fundraising appeals for the Israeli military. The U.S. Supreme Court Monday gave the Trump administration the green light to use the 18th century wartime Alien Enemies Act to expel Venezuelan immigrants and asylum seekers, but said that any target for removal must have the right to a court hearing. Last month, the Trump administration sent three planes with 238 Venezuelans to El Salvador in defiance of a judge's order. They were then transferred to a maximum security mega prison. On Monday, Chief Justice John Roberts also temporarily stayed a lower court's ruling, which ordered the Trump administration to bring back a Salvadoran father to his home in Maryland after he was wrongfully sent to the Salvadoran mega prison despite having protected status. Later in the broadcast, we'll get an update on the case of Kilmer Abrego Garcia, who the Trump administration claims is unable to bring back to the United States, even though the Trump administration is paying $6 million to imprison asylum seekers and immigrants at the El Salvador prison. Meanwhile, the loved ones of Andre Hernandez Romero, a gay Venezuelan asylum seeker who was also expelled to El Salvador, say they fear for Romero's safety at the notorious Secat mega prison. Romero appears to have been removed because he has tattoos of crowns, one on each forearm, with the words mom and dad. Experts say tattoos are not an identifier of membership in the Tren de Aragua gang, as immigration officials falsely claim. He comes from a community in Venezuela where they celebrate Three Kings Day. In more immigration news, a mother and her three children have been released from a Texas detention center nearly 2 weeks after they were taken by Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents in a raid at a dairy production facility near the town of Sackett's Harbor in upstate New York. The raid happened not far from the home of Trump's so-called border czar, Tom Homan, where advocates held protests demanding the family's release. At the time of the raid, witnesses said a group of at least seven people, including the family, were handcuffed before being removed from a home at the dairy farm and put in a van. The three children were enrolled in public school, one of them in the third grade, the other two in 10th and 11th grade. The Dominican Republic is enacting a fresh series of border restrictions targeting asylum seekers from Haiti as thousands continue to flee amid political instability and a worsening humanitarian crisis. On Sunday, the Dominican president, Luis Abinader, moved to deploy hundreds of additional soldiers and ordered stepped-up surveillance along the Haitian border. He's also vowed to expedite the construction of a border wall. Dominican authorities have been repeatedly accused of widespread violence and human rights abuses against Haitians. This all comes as humanitarian groups continue to raise alarm over spiraling violence in Haiti, with more than 260 people killed during the recent gang attacks on two communities in Port-au-Prince, according to a UN report published Monday. The report details concerns with Haitian authorities and Kenyan armed forces that were deployed to Haiti, which on one occasion took at least 5 hours to respond to a gang attack. Haitians have repeatedly taken to the streets to protest the government's failure to address the security crisis, as armed gangs have now seized some 85% of the capital. President Trump has threatened to increase U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods by an additional 50% unless Beijing rescinds retaliatory tariffs imposed on U.S. goods. Trump said the new tariffs would take effect on Wednesday, raising the U.S. tariff on Chinese goods to 104%. In response, China's Commerce Ministry promised to fight Trump's tariffs to the end. After headlines, we'll look at how auto workers in the U.S. and Mexico are responding to Trump's trade war. A federal appeals court has overturned the Trump administration's firing of two top federal labor officials, ordering they be restored to their positions. Trump abruptly fired National Labor Relations Board member Gwynne Wilcox in January. Kathy Harris, who led the Merit Systems Protections Board, a judicial body that oversees protections for federal workers, was ousted weeks later. Federal law says that NLRB and MSPB members can only be fired for neglect or malfeasance. Trump officials are expected to ignore the latest ruling, likely taking the legal fight to the U.S. Supreme Court. In 2021, Wilcox became the first Black woman on the NLRB after being confirmed by the Senate following her nomination by President Biden. And a fired Justice Department lawyer is accusing her former employer of intimidation tactics after the department planned to send armed U.S. marshals to deliver a letter warning her against testifying to Congress about what she's called the ongoing corruption of the Trump administration. Liz Oyer told lawmakers Monday the marshals ultimately called off their plans to visit her home after she confirmed also receiving the warning letter via email. Oyer spent 10 years as a federal public defender before then-President Biden appointed her to serve as pardon attorney 3 years ago. She was testifying to a joint hearing convened by Democrats on the House and Senate Judiciary Committees.
The letter was a warning to me about the risks of testifying here today. But I am here because I will not be bullied into concealing the ongoing corruption and abuse of power at the Department of Justice. DOJ is entrusted with keeping us safe upholding the rule of law and protecting our civil rights. It is not a personal favor bank for the president.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
President Donald Trump threatened new and even higher tariffs on China Monday after imposing severe tariffs against nearly all U.S. trading partners and rattling financial markets for days. Trump told reporters Monday during a meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in the Oval Office, quote, "We have many, many countries that are coming to negotiate deals with us," unquote. Democrats like Senator Chris Murphy have called the sweeping tariffs, quote, "a tool to try to compel pledges of loyalty," unquote. Independent Senator Bernie Sanders has said, quote, "We need a rational and well-thought-out trade policy, not arbitrary actions from the White House," unquote. Meanwhile, the tariffs have support from some in the labor movement, including one of the most progressive unions in the country, the United Auto Workers. Trump invited about 24 auto workers to his so-called Liberation Day executive order signing last week when he announced the new tariffs and referred to them many times.
American steel workers, auto workers, farmers, and skilled craftsmen, we have a lot of them here with us today. They really suffered gravely. They watched in anguish as foreign leaders have stolen our jobs, foreign cheaters have ransacked our factories, and foreign scavengers have torn apart our once beautiful American dream.
As the economic impact of Trump's tariffs played out, United Auto Workers President Sean Fain outlined possible benefits they may have for the auto industry in an interview with CBS Face the Nation before Trump outlined the tariffs.
Well, all you have to do is look at the history of the United States, especially in auto manufacturing in the last 30 years with the inception of NAFTA and unfair trade laws. We've seen over 90,000 manufacturing facilities leave the United States. We've seen in the big three alone in the last 20 plus years, 65 plants have closed. Look, tariffs aren't the total solution. Tariffs are a tool in the toolbox to get these companies to do the right thing, and the intent behind it is to bring jobs back here.
As workers brace for uncertainty and fallout from Trump's tariffs, we'll speak in a minute with a UAW member, an auto worker in Michigan. First, this is an auto worker organizer in Mexico he put us in touch with, named Israel Cervantes, who helped found the National Independent Union for Workers in the Automotive Industry. He's a former General Motors worker. The two organized together in 2019 when Mexican GM workers refused to work overtime while GM workers in the U.S. were on strike. Cervantes explained how Trump's tariffs will impact Mexican workers.
Pues hoy vemos con este aumento de aranceles que va a tener un impacto significativo en la economía.
Today we see this increase in tariffs that is going to have a significant impact on the economy, export, competitiveness, and employment. Because by adding this tariff, companies will earn a little bit less than they were earning by exporting units, in this case in the automotive industry. However, it will also be affected by upcoming labor cuts, which will affect the economy of many families in Mexico. It also affects competitiveness because it will be a lot of competition between workers in the United States and Mexico and even Canada with these tariffs, especially since we are part of the USMCA, the Free Trade Agreement. So we see it as a mistake or as an unfair imposition. It will greatly affect both or all three countries. Regarding Trump's policies, we are definitely going to see how workers will begin to fight amongst ourselves, thinking that in Mexico we are taking jobs away from people in the United States. So the most important thing today is that unions currently present in these nations unite in solidarity to improve these policies, eliminate these policies, and unite against this president, against these decisions he's making that will only negatively affect the three countries.
That's Mexican auto worker Israel Cervantes sitting in front of a sign that said GM. Trump's tariffs will impact the vast majority of countries in the world, something like 185 countries and territories. For more, we go to Warren, Michigan, to Sean Crawford, a UAW Local 160 member who works for General Motors as well and is joining us on his break. His new piece for Labor Notes is headlined, "Will Trump's Tariffs Be Good for Auto Workers?" Sean, welcome to Democracy Now! You begin your piece talking about the man we just heard, the GM auto worker in Mexico, Israel Cervantes. Can you tell us his story and then respond, well, to your own question, the headline of how it will affect workers around, all from U.S. to Mexico?
Good morning, Amy. Happy to be here talking with you today. Israel Cervantes is a man I have a deep respect for. He unprompted went on basically a small-scale strike by refusing overtime, by refusing to produce General Motors' most profitable vehicles, the large trucks that I, at the time, was also building at Flint Truck Assembly. And I thought this was just a wonderful gesture of international solidarity, totally unprompted and uncoordinated, just pretty much done out of the spirit of solidarity. And it really flies in the face of the, you know, the negative narrative a lot of folks have about Mexican workers taking jobs and not caring about their fellow workers in the United States. And so I always go back to that for a feeling of inspiration and solidarity. And as far as will the tariffs benefit workers in the U.S., honestly, it remains to be seen. I think a lot of the evidence so far points to no. And like I mentioned in the article, there's an old truism in bargaining that you really can only believe something when it's in writing. And building massive plants in the United States is not in writing. No one has agreed to it yet. No company has broken ground on any new facilities. This is something that has to be done with careful consideration of logistics and investments and the longevity of such a venture. And Trump is a particularly impulsive and erratic president, and I doubt that will be comforting enough for any company to want to break ground on something as large as a new manufacturing facility.
Sean, I wanted to ask you, in terms of the Trump is saying that the tariffs will help American workers by boosting U.S. industry and especially the auto industry. But the reality is, from the research that I've seen, in 1950, at the height of U.S. power, this country was producing 80% of all the automobiles in the world. Recently, in 2023, we were producing only 11% of all the automobiles in the world, whereas China is now producing 30% of all the cars manufactured in the world. And when it comes to electric vehicles, of the 14 million electric vehicles registered worldwide in 2023, 60% of them were registered in China. This is a stunning superiority in Chinese manufacturing that's been decades in the making. So it's not just a couple of years. How will these tariffs possibly reverse this trend?
I mean, you have to keep in mind that the heyday of the American auto industry was post-World War II, when a large portion of our competition was basically bombed into the dirt. And barring another world war that results in something like that, heaven forbid, I doubt we're going to be quite in the same position as we were back in the 1950s. And there's also another factor that people often fail to consider is that the thing that made these manufacturing jobs so wonderful back in the day, and I use wonderful kind of lightly, because honestly, many manufacturing jobs are quite awful, horrible, dehumanizing, dirty, dangerous, and result in major injuries. And I can speak to that from personal experience. But nevertheless, the thing that made these jobs great and the thing that made America great at that time, the heyday of America post-World War II, was a strong labor movement. And in order, you know, even if we do end up bringing back all these shiny new factories, unless these workers are unionized into militant independent unions that demand the value of their labor that's being extracted, we're never going to get back to anything remotely close to that. And then on top of that, you know, we have to consider the fact that automation and AI is a huge presence in our economy today. unless we address that, the effects of automation and the fact that so much more work is being done by robotics now, you know, where it used to take a whole line of workers to do something, now one robot will do the same amount of work. Unless we can figure out a way as a society to decide what is done with the products of that automation process and the value that it's creating, we're never going to see that level of prosperity again. So the discussion really needs to go further away from, you know, I hate hearing they're always harping on foreigners. But what about the capitalists that are exploiting our labor? What about the capitalists that have been screwing us over for all these years? It's not foreigners, but it's the people with money that shipped our jobs overseas. You know, these workers in Mexico and Canada. Go ahead.
Yeah, Sean, just to follow up on that issue, part of the problem in terms of producing automobiles here in the United States vis-a-vis in other countries that gets very little attention is that many other countries, including Canada, have national health insurance. So the auto makers don't actually have to pay for the health insurance of their own workers, whereas here in the United States with our privatized health care system, that falls on the automakers. I'm wondering your thoughts about how the automobile industry could become more competitive than other manufacturers if we had national health insurance or some form of government paid health insurance?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that. That's honestly something I feel very strong about. It's something that I would like to see not only to make our industry competitive, but just for the economic well-being and happiness of the populace. You know, anyone who lives in the industrial Midwest who's seen the destruction and of our communities over the last 40 years to go from per capita one of the richest places in the world where, you know, workers actually shared in the wealth they created to one of the most impoverished where deaths of despair are common. We all know that the employers are not necessarily the most reliable partners. They use us up and they spit us out when it's convenient for them. And so not having healthcare that's reliant on your employer would be a game changer, not only for competitiveness with Canada, but also as if that's really a goal that I'm looking for, which it's not. You know, what I want is solidarity with Canada, but it would be a boon for our quality of life, our freedom to be able to choose a job or to start a venture of our own, or, you know, really just have freedom and a good quality of life.
Sean, I know you have to go back to work in a minute, but I wanted to ask you about a point that you make that's critical. Two quick questions. You write, my proposal would be to tax or tariff only those vehicles and parts, both domestic and foreign, that are produced in facilities that violate workers' rights. If you can talk about that, and then also where you differ from Sean Fain, the president of your union, the United Auto Workers.
Well, as far as strategic tariffs, like, I'm not opposed to tariffs, and I'm not opposed to protecting our industry, but what I want to see is a protection of the working class, right? Because it's not all about me. It's not all about, you know, keeping the foreigners out. If you're an American like myself, my dad is from Poland. You know, people come from all over the world to become American citizens. I have no problem with my Mexican brothers and sisters or my Canadian brothers and sisters. What I want to do is, if we're going to penalize companies for producing things the way we don't want to, how about, you know, try to imagine what it would look like, a truly pro-worker tariff policy. You know, what would empower the working class? What would strengthen the working class? And to me, what would most strengthen the working class is by punishing companies that fight unions, like Elon Musk's Tesla, for example. If you're an anti-union company, if you exploit labor, we're going to penalize you. We're going to tax you. We're going to tariff you until you, you know, actually respect your workers' rights and their ability to organize. And as far as where I differ from Sean Fain, I supported Sean Fain in the election, and I think he's done a fantastic job as UAW president. That said, I don't think Trump's tariff policies are in the best interests of the working class as a whole. And I would really like to see the tariffs applied much more strategically in a way that encompasses a mentality of solidarity, brings us closer together, and doesn't divide the working class. Because I've gotten to know over the years brothers and sisters from Mexico and Canada, and I have a great deal of respect for them. And I want to see us grow together as a working class and as a global labor movement so we can take on these companies, which are also global, because just having a nationalistic viewpoint has not been working for us and has resulted in a lot of these layoffs that we've experienced throughout the years.
Well, Sean Kerford, we want to thank you for using your break to talk to us as you are in Warren, Michigan, working at the General Motors plant. Sean is UAW Local 160 member in Michigan. His recent piece for Labor Notes will link to "Will Trump's Tariffs Be Good for Auto Workers?" Next up, the Supreme Court has paused a court-imposed order for the U.S. to bring home a Maryland father who is mistakenly flown that admission from the Trump administration to a supermax prison in El Salvador. We'll speak with the family's lawyer and go to San Salvador to look more closely at this notorious supermax prison that's jailing hundreds of immigrants and asylum seekers sent from the United States. Back in 30 seconds. Coming by Wu Lai. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Supreme Court issued two rulings Monday related to the Trump administration expelling immigrants to a notorious supermax prison in El Salvador. In one case, the court ruled in a 5-4 decision to allow the Trump administration to resume, for now, its use of the 1798 Alien Enemies Act to send Venezuelan nationals to El Salvador. However, the justices ruled the targeted individuals are entitled to challenge their removal from the United States. But it's unclear what this means for the 238 Venezuelans who were sent to El Salvador last month in defiance of a judge's order and imprisoned at this notorious prison outside San Salvador. In a separate decision, Chief Justice John Roberts temporarily paused a lower court order that instructed the Trump administration to bring back a Maryland dad who'd been mistakenly sent to El Salvador. The Trump administration's acknowledged that Kilmer Abrego Garcia was removed from the U.S. in error on March 15th. But the administration claims they're now powerless to bring him back to his family, even though the Trump administration is paying El Salvador $6 million a year to imprison immigrants expelled from the United States. Abrego Garcia, who's from El Salvador, was granted protected legal status in the U.S. by an immigration court in 2019, prohibiting the federal government from sending him back to El Salvador after he fled gang violence there. On Sunday, federal judge Paula Chinas accused the Trump administration of committing a grievous error that shocks the conscience by seizing and expelling Abrego Garcia. She was the judge who'd ordered Abrego Garcia to be returned home by midnight Monday night. Meanwhile, the Justice Department has placed a senior immigration lawyer on indefinite leave after he acknowledged in court Friday that the Trump administration had made a mistake in sending Abrego Garcia back to El Salvador. On Friday, his wife, Jennifer, briefly spoke to reporters.
I want to say thank you to everyone that has helped us, that has supported us in fighting this. And we will continue fighting for Kilmer, for my husband. Thank you.
We're joined now by two guests. From San Salvador, Noah Bullock is with us, the executive director of Cristosal, a human rights group in Central America. His recent piece for Foreign Policy, The Horror Inside the Salvadoran Prisons Where Trump is Sending Migrants. And in Virginia, we're joined by Simon Sandoval Moschenberg, an immigration lawyer representing Kilmer Armando Abrego Garcia and his family. Let's begin with Simon. If you could talk about the latest ruling and how it affects your client, how he was removed to El Salvador, how he's been imprisoned, and now the ruling of Chief Justice Roberts.
Sure. I mean, this case arose out of an accident, right? I mean, the government admits that they didn't have any legal basis whatsoever to deport him to El Salvador. That's not entirely out of the ordinary. You know, it happens from time to time. I've been practicing immigration law for nearly two decades. Erroneous deportations happen. But in every previous such case that I've handled, and I've spoken with several other immigration lawyers, you know, as soon as you bring this to their attention, they sort of, and convince them that they've made a mistake, they immediately set the wheels in motion to fix it, right? They bend over backwards. I've had plenty of clients return to the United States before. I've spoken with lawyers who've had clients removed to Iraq by accident, and, you know, we managed to get them back. What was different about this case is that we brought it to their attention, we filed a lawsuit, and there was just essentially no response whatsoever. And the posture of the administration has been, yeah, we made a mistake. No, we're not going to do anything whatsoever to fix it. And no court can order us to fix it. That's really what's remarkable about this case. And then they've dug in their heels at every step of the way, at the district court, at the Court of Appeals, and now the Supreme Court. I mean, it's ridiculous that this case is at the Supreme Court at all. The government is really the ones who've chosen to make a big national issue out of this particular case, which really should have just been resolved very quickly and quietly.
Simon, when you say that these kinds of errors in deportations sometimes occur, the judge in this particular case, the federal district judge in Maryland, stated that the only evidence against your client consisted, quote, of nothing more than his Chicago Bulls hat and hoodie and a vague, uncorroborated allegation from a confidential informant claiming he belonged to MS-13's Western clique, a place he's never lived. This seems to go a little bit beyond just an error. What about this whole issue of how the government is identifying supposed potential not only criminal aliens, but people that are destabilizing the country?
Right. That all actually dates back to 2019. None of that is even contemporary, right? He was first arrested by ICE in 2019 when he was working as a day laborer in front of a Home Depot. There was this anonymous tip, this confidential informant, combined with the fact that he was wearing a Chicago Bulls hat, that as far as ICE was concerned, was, you know, more than enough to label him a gang member. When he was first detained by ICE, he had a preliminary hearing, and the immigration judge essentially said, well, I don't know what's going on. We've got this confidential tip. I can't be satisfied. I don't know what's going on, so I'm going to deny his release. So the judge essentially ordered that he continued to be detained during his immigration proceedings. But then he had a trial, right? And he won his trial. The judge ordered him relief from removal, ordered that he could not be deported to El Salvador, granted him withholding of removal. And the government, the Trump administration at the time, didn't even bother to appeal, right? They just sort of said, oh, all right, that's fine. They released him from detention and they gave him a work permit. And he's been working, which he's renewed ever since. And he's been working legally now as a sheet metal worker apprentice on a legal work permit ever since. So to the extent that they've got these allegations against him, they're not even sort of contemporary allegations. They're 6 years old.
And in terms of this whole issue of the government claiming that it can't, it has no ability to bring him back. Talk about that. And also, the government has a contract with the government of El Salvador to hold these deportees.
Right. I mean, the government's sort of main defense here is in their pleadings, in the case, leaving aside their rhetoric from the White House press secretary, The government's main defense is not that he's supposedly an MS-13 member. It's this sort of impossibility defense. It would be impossible, right? How could we possibly do it? They've provided no evidence to that effect, right? And we provided fairly significant evidence that there is an agreement between the United States and El Salvador vis-a-vis this prison. We've got the president of El Salvador, Bukele, tweeting that he's receiving $6 million from the United States to house United States detainees in this prison. Marco Rubio, in response to that tweet, tweeting, "Thank you, President Bukele." We've got the fact that after our case was filed, right, after we had a preliminary scheduling conference with the judge, so they were already on notice of what they had done to Mr. Abrego Garcia, they put Kristi Noem within the walls of that prison, got her out again on a same-day basis. And plenty of other evidence, which, you know, is certainly circumstantial evidence, but a mountain of circumstantial evidence adds up, especially when faced with no contrary evidence from the government. And the district judge in Maryland found, and then the Court of Appeals in Richmond agreed, that there's enough evidence to show that we have an agreement with the government of El Salvador, and that pursuant to that agreement, we could request them back.
I want to bring Noah Bullock into this conversation. He's in San Salvador, not that far from the prison where migrants, where asylum seekers are being sent from the United States, this SECOT prison. For the first time, Noah, it must be something for you to see this kind of focus from the United States on what you've been noting and other human rights groups for quite some time. The fact is, hundreds of Salvadoran prisoners, is this right, have died in El Salvador's prisons, the same prison system that the U.S. is paying millions of dollars to the president, who has declared a state of exception in your country. Explain what that is and what we should know about these prisons.
Sure, and thank you for the invitation, Amy. The state of exception, in some ways, is similar to the Alien Enemies Act in the United States, only that it's applied to Salvadoran citizens. It's an emergency declaration that restricts due process rights, and has been in place for 3 years. It was an emergency decree that was originally put in place to combat gang violence, but in over the course of 3 years, 85,000 Salvadorans have been detained under this decree. And in our investigation of cases, the overwhelming majority of those detentions have been illegal. People detained without evidence, without prior investigations or even judicial warrants, purely on the discretion of the police officers and soldiers that are rounding them up. And once they're in prison, they're able to be held for up to 3 years now without going to trial, without formally being accused of a crime. And in prison, they're cut off from communication from their families. They don't have access to defense attorneys. These conditions constitute, under international law, forced disappearances. And inside the prisons, we've been able to document systematic torture, physical abuse, but also denial of access to food, water, clothing, healthcare, hygiene. Much has been made of SECOT, the mega prison that was built during the state of exception. It's a very new prison. But the majority of the 85,000 people who have been detained are being held in older maximum security prisons. And the conditions of physical abuse combined with the intentional denial of access of basic necessities, according to our research, has produced the deaths of at least 368 people. But the testimonial evidence of prisoners or former prisoners is that that number is likely much higher. So while the focus of the media attention and even the government's own propaganda has been on SECOT, this new prison, the majority of the people detained in the state of exception are in other prisons where conditions are likely much worse.
And Noah, could you talk about there have been more than 7,000 petitions of habeas corpus submitted to the Salvadoran Supreme Court? How have the courts handled these petitions so far?
Yeah, that's another important parallel to draw here with the situation in the United States. When the president's party won a supermajority in the legislature, the very first night, the very first legislative session, they overthrew the constitutional court here, which is the highest court in the land. And they installed new magistrates that would be loyal to the president. After that, they purged about a third of the judges in the lower courts and put the rest of them basically on notice that they could be removed at the discretion of the new Supreme Court. So there's a lack of judicial independence. And that's what we've seen. You mentioned the number. We estimate that about 7,200 habeas corpus claims have been made to the Constitutional Court during the state of exception, and less than 1% of those have been resolved by the court, meaning that effectively the constitutional right to habeas corpus has been denied systematically to Salvadorans. We also have documented how in the state of exception, they've created new courts, specific tribunals with judges whose identities are secret. So these are ad hoc secret tribunals that were created specifically to convict people detained in the state of exception. And reforms to the penal code will allow the Attorney General in El Salvador, who was also installed through a legislative coup in that same night, to prosecute the people in groups of 900. They've even said publicly up to 2,000. The Salvadoran government has said specifically that they're not intending even to try these people individually, rather in groups. And when we've looked at cases and our lawyers who have tried to exercise the defense of people who have been detained with chronic illnesses, physical handicaps, and even pregnant women, the accused are unable to exercise even the most minimal defense in these tribunals, and they're accused without any individual evidence brought against them. That reminds me a little bit of the case of Kilmar, right? That there's no evidence been brought against him other than somebody said he's in a gang.
I want to end with Simon in Virginia. What happens next with Kilmar Armando Obrego-Garcia? You have the Chief Justice pausing the timeline. The rule was last night by midnight he had to be brought back. So what happens now? This goes to the full Supreme Court?
Yeah, the Chief Justice entered a brief administrative stay just so that the Supreme Court could, you know, essentially get its work done, right? The Supreme Court didn't even get the case till 2 o'clock on Monday. The deadline was midnight at the 5-hour flight. We have every confidence that the Supreme Court is going to work on this and issue a ruling very quickly. But yes, it will go to all 9 justices of the Supreme Court. I expect and hope that they will rule in our client's favor and that they'll do so as quickly as possible this week. They'll set a new deadline, right? They'll give the government however many hours or however many days to comply. And then we expect the government to start working in good faith to actually do that. There's been not one iota of good faith so far in this case. They haven't reached out to us at all. They clearly didn't make any steps to start complying with the judge's order, you know, in case their legal strategy of appeals didn't work. It's time for them to actually start doing the right thing here.
Simon Sandoval-Moschenberg, we thank you so much for being with us. Immigration lawyer representing Kilmar Armando Obrego-Garcia, who is now imprisoned in the notorious SECA, the supermax outside of San Salvador. And Noah Bullock, executive director of CristaSal, a human rights group in Central America, speaking to us from San Salvador. We'll link to your piece, The Horror Inside the Salvadoran Prisons Where Trump is Sending Migrants. Next up, Black Americans Are Not Surprised, writes Ford Professor Christina Greer. Stay with us.
No more. No more.
Sweet Honey in the Rock. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The National Park Service Monday appeared to have restored its original webpage on the history of the Underground Railroad following a backlash over its deletion of a prominent image of abolitionist Harriet Tubman, as well as edits to the text that minimized the horrors of slavery, instead talking about white-black cooperation. A Washington Post investigation published Sunday found in the weeks following Trump's inauguration, Tubman's photograph had been removed and replaced with images of Postal Service stamps that highlighted this black-white cooperation. Late last month, President Trump issued an executive order titled Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History, which claims the Smithsonian's museums have come under, quote, the influence of a divisive race-centered ideology, unquote. The order singles out the National Museum of African American History and culture inaugurated by President Obama in 2016. On Friday, Kevin Young, the director of the museum since 2021, resigned. Our next guest argues nothing about these efforts to whitewash American history nor the Trump administration's expanding crackdown on dissent and immigration should be surprising to Americans. Fordham University professor Christina Greer's latest op-ed for the New York Times is headlined, Black Americans Are Not Surprised. She writes, quote, it's frightening and disappointing, but not surprising if one knows anything about the black experience in America, unquote. Christina Greer, thank you so much for being with us. You wrote the book, How to Build a Democracy, from Fannie Lou Hamer and Barbara Jordan to Stacey Abrams, as well as the book Black Ethnics, Race, Immigration, and the Pursuit of the American Dream. Welcome to Democracy Now! Why don't you take it from the title, from there? Black Americans are not surprised.
Thanks, Amy. Well, you know, there's just been so much hand-wringing about how could this be happening? What's going on? This isn't the country I know. And so many Black Americans are like, this is absolutely the country we know. This is a country that's made a lot of progress over the decades, the centuries. But there's always progress and regress in this nation. And so if we think about post-Civil War Reconstruction and the great progress that we made, and we had elected officials, Black elected officials, even in the South, and then that was a very short-lived experiment. And we had decades of brutality in Jim Crow, military, Black military officers being lynched in their uniforms, redlining, the refusal to include Black women in many of the New Deal policies, therefore the lack of generational wealth that was able to be passed down because of Black domestic workers, you know, people being fired. You know, we always joke, Good Times, the TV show, the Norman Lear TV show with John Amos, you know, his famous tagline is, you know, Florida was last hired and first fired. These are all things that Black Americans are fully aware of. Nothing that's happening right now is a shock. It's just a shock to so many white people because it's never happened to them. But what we're seeing, sadly, happened in the 21st century. So many of our parents and grandparents have told us these stories. My parents, who were very young and hip and we traveled together, they went to segregated schools. My father integrated his high school in Miami. My mother never went to integrated schools a day in her life. You know, and these are people who are still walking among us. Ruby Bridges isn't even 70 years old. So many people have no idea who Ruby Bridges even is, right? The little Black girl who integrated Louisiana public schools. And there's been a systemic erasure of Black history consistently, book bannings consistently. So as I write in the piece, you know, we kind of jump from slavery and Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass to all of a sudden civil rights. We jump over 100 years to Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks. And then all of a sudden we jump a few more decades to a post-racial Barack Obama. But there's a really, really brutal and bloody and dark history of Black people in this country at the hands of white people, not all white people, but at the hands of enough white people to push us into a really hard conversation that we've refused to have as a nation. And because of that, so many people are hand-wringing and head-scratching at this particular moment.
And Professor Greer, I wanted to ask you about the Trump administration's not only attacks on higher education over issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion, but now that the U.S. Department of Education is requiring all public school systems within a few days to certify that they've done away with what the administration calls discriminatory diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Your response.
How is it discriminatory to know one's history? I mean, we can't move forward as a nation collectively, and that's what all of my books are about, really trying to figure out how do we move forward if we don't understand our collective past. You know, white people and black people are inextricably linked in this country, not just our last names and our families, but the brutality that, you know, so many people experienced on this land. It's our shared history. Black history is American history. And to not understand it is to not fully understand this country. It's to not understand why LBJ was such a great president and helped push forward the Civil Rights Act, and the Voting Rights Act, and the Immigration Act, and the complexities of how he did that as a white Southerner. To not understand this country is to not understand Eisenhower, you know, integrating the armed forces by executive order, and how we've used executive orders in the past for some really amazing things, the Emancipation Proclamation, integrating the armed forces, and for some really horrific things, i.e. Japanese internment camps that put in Italians and Germans as well. So to not understand our shared history is to sort of meet the moment and not know where we're going. And I think that's part of the frustration that so many Americans have right now. I think that's part of the confusion that is deliberate right now. We have to have, you know, children can understand complex issues. I think anyone who's been around kids long enough, if you present them with information in a way that is palatable, they get it. And it's not divisive to understand how there was U.S. chattel slavery in this country. It's not divisive to understand how we once had thousands of different Native American tribes across the nation. You know, I live in New York State. We had a robust Native American community that is no longer in many parts of the state. And so it's our shared collective identity that can help us be a great nation. And, you know, if we want to just get to brass tacks, being a diverse nation helps you make money. That's a language that some people understand, right? When you have diversity, when you have equity, when you have inclusion, it's actually better for your bottom line. So I think Target is finding out how diversity, equity, inclusion is better for their bottom line. I think a lot of businesses will slowly realize, you know, if you don't understand the bus boycotts of Montgomery from the 1950s and 60s, you know, and boycotts in various lunch counters across the South, those were economic boycotts that had obviously other consequences. But, you know, to get racial equity, there was an economic component to so much of what brave Black Americans did in the South. And I think a lot of corporations are going to find out, in the 21st century version of what those economic boycotts can look like to move forward a more equitable agenda.
And I wanted to ask you as well about the, you mentioned the Trump administration's targeting of especially dissident students and foreign students. For example, you are a Tufts graduate. Your response to a Tufts student, Rumeysa Öztürk, who was sent to Louisiana after being driven to Vermont, but was picked up by immigration agents in Somerville, Massachusetts, the video that captured her arrest and detention. Your sense of what is how universities should respond to these direct incursions of the government into their student bodies and on their campuses to seize students.
Well, you know, as a university professor, you know, the university is a space for intellectual ideas and debates. We cannot have a space where it's filled with fear and silence. And so to see that horrific video is frightening. I think universities have to band together. This is what is the point of an endowment if during hard times you're not going to use it? We know that there are some universities that are larger and more powerful than others. If they stick together, collective action, which is what I talk about in all of my books, you can actually get a lot more than sort of being picked off one by one. We do know, I mean, this is, again, time and time in America, if you know your history, you know, as you target one group, many groups don't ever think that they'll be targeted. And it's like, your day will come. So if you do not come together and think of a strategy, I mean, as an intellectual space, we debate these ideas. This is what has made this nation actually move forward as one of the leaders in the world, for better or for worse. And so this idea that immigrants take away from the robust intellectual space is patently false, first of all, but is creating a level of fear where, you know, what is the point of a university if we have homogeneity of thought and silence?
We're going to have to.
It makes no sense.
We're going to have to leave it there. But of course, we'll continue to follow this issue. 8 more international students have had their visas revoked. 150 have been revoked in the last few weeks. Fordham professor Christina Greer will link to your New York Times op-ed, Black Americans Are Not Surprised. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Thank you so much for joining us.
The Independent Wrestling Academy is back. On Saturday, May 17th, catch Stepping Up 2 live at the Spire on 82 Sydenham Street. This family-friendly, all-ages professional wrestling event is headlined by 2 title matches. Alexei Orlov defends his Academy Championship against Dino Benjamin. And the IWA Tag Team titles are on the line in the first ever Tag Team Eliminator Gauntlet. Tickets are available now at iwacanada.ca. $15 if you order in advance, $20 at the door. Doors open at 5 p.m. and bell time is 5:30.